Welcome to ArchaeoEd, a podcast about the civilizations of the ancient Americas. You know, the ones that American history books never talk about. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Barnhart. I've been an archaeologist, an explorer, and a seeker of esoteric knowledge all over the planet for over 30 years now. In this podcast, I'll share what I've learned. Sometimes it'll be stories of my adventures. Other times, it'll be things I've learned along the way. It'll be whatever I feel like talking about because this is my podcast, beholden to no one. Are you ready? I'm ready. Let's go. Season 5, Episode 7, Ancient American Weapons. I thought this would be a fun topic, but I want to start with a disclaimer. I am not an ancient weapons expert. I've learned a lot about it over the years, and that's what I'll share here, what I know. I'm sure there's a lot that I don't know about this subject. This is just off the top of my head, with the occasional peek at Google or my library to make sure I have my facts right. If you know something to contribute, please share it in the comments. I love it when these episodes become conversations among my listeners. I also want to let you know about a new segment I've started doing after each episode. I'm calling it One More Thing. It's 3 to 5 minutes of things that didn't make the episode, but that I was thinking about. They'll be for my Patreon supporters only and accessed through the Patreon portal. Okay, I'll break this episode up into 3 parts: North America, Mesoamerica, and South America. One issue that will come up repeatedly is, how do we distinguish between a tool for hunting and a weapon? The truth is that almost anything can be a weapon if we want it to be. Heck, people in prison get killed with toothbrushes. What I'll try to focus on are purpose-made weapons, or a culture's lack thereof. How can we learn about ancient weapons? There are lots of ways, but there are 3 big ones. Number 1, artifacts, actually finding weapons. Number 2 is depictions in art, seeing weapons in art, perhaps how they're used as well. And number 3, osteological evidence of violent attack. By that last one, I mean skeletal evidence of a violent death. Even then, determining who died in a fight and who was sacrificed can get tricky. But with that brief preface, let's start in North America. During the Paleolithic, more or less 10 to 12,000 years ago, we get our first thing that could be a purpose-made weapon, the atlatl. The atlatl was a short spear thrown with a handheld stick with a groove in it. Prevailing thought is that they were used to hunt the megafauna of the time, mastodons, mammoths, and bison antiquus. Were they also used as weapons against humans? Well, we don't really have enough information to say. We have no Paleolithic art depicting such, nor do we have any skeletons that show death by atlatl pathology. Now, we also don't have many Paleolithic skeletons, so again, that lack of data. When we get to the Archaic period, at least that part changes. We do have lots of burials and skeletons. Especially in what's now called the Midwest, we have archaic people buried in shell mounds along rivers. A significant portion of them have evidence of violent deaths. We see smashed-in heads and broken limbs. In a small number of cases, we also find completely severed heads and limbs. What we don't have is art recording it, or an artifact that we know is a purpose-made weapon. There are lots of stone spearheads found, but were they for hunting or war, or both? We can't say. After the Archaic in North America, we start getting our first permanent sedentary communities. All the Archaic communities were at least semi-nomadic and rarely over 100 people each. Starting around 2000 BCE and going up really to about 500 CE, large permanent communities started happening. From 1700 to 1000 BCE, we've got Poverty Point in Louisiana, a city of 5,000 plus inhabitants. From 1000 to 100 BCE, the area around Ohio had the burial mound building Adena people. They evolve into the Hopewell, who for about 500 years create much larger earthen constructions and establish a trade network that extends across all of the eastern United States. At the same time, the basket maker people are growing in numbers and settling all across the American Southwest. But as far as archaeology can tell, none of those people were waging war on each other. Again, yes, there were spear points, but those were probably primarily hunting tools. Unlike the archaic burials, very little evidence of violent death is found in any of their graves. It's also not indicated in their settlement patterns. There's no evidence of defensive walls or intense clustering for safety in numbers. Around 500 or 600 CE, that begins to change. There's heated debate on this issue, but for me, that change was triggered by the introduction of the bow and arrow. Arrows need tiny, light stone tips to fly well. They're very different from the heavier ones hafted to spears. So archaeologically, it's easy to detect when bow and arrow technology arrives. An unanswered question that bugs me and most archaeologists is why did it take so long to arrive? It came down to what's now the U.S. from Canada. But there's good evidence that the bow and arrow was there and in Alaska as early as 2500 BCE. Globally, the bow and arrow has been around for 70,000 years. The very earliest were found in South Africa. Back in the Americas, the technology sat isolated in Canada for 3,000 years. Then at about 600 CE, it shows up south of the Great Lakes. From there, it's less than 200 years for it to make its way to every corner of North America and all the way down into Central America. It really feels like we're missing something there. Nevertheless, that's what we currently know. At first, the bow and arrow changed hunting. It's hard to hit a bird or a rabbit with a spear, but bow and arrows make it easy. We can see an uptick of those kinds of smaller animals in the diets of Midwesterners of the 600 to 800 CE. We think it also changed the range hunters had to go from home, less hunting parties, far afield. It may have resulted in more isolated, independent communities. During this time period, a tradition of small effigy mounds began in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. Each effigy mound had a burial inside. As time went on, more and more of those people that were buried in the effigy mounds had arrows in them. And then, around 900 CE, communities started to cluster and build wooden walls around them. Those walls were built to keep out potential enemies. Bear in mind, this had never happened in North America. These walled city builders became what I consider North America's first warfare practicing civilization, the Mississippians. From roughly 900 CE all the way to European contact in the 1500s, Mississippian city-states covered the eastern United States and fought with each other en masse. They had the bow and arrow. They also had spears and maces. Artifacts attesting to those weapons are found as grave offerings, but they're also frequently depicted in Mississippian art. The Mississippian mace is a particularly unique weapon. It had a wooden handle 8 to 12 inches long that the stone upper half was seated into. The stone business end was kind of a combination sword and mace. They were about a foot long and napped out of chert. The stone was thick in the middle, like a mace, but sharpened on the sides, like a sword. The typical top was rounded with a stumpy spike on both sides. They're called crown form maces because their tops resemble European royal crowns. The flat side could be used as a bludgeoning weapon, and the sharp edge could cut into flesh. Carved into shell, stone, and ceramics, We have images of Mississippian warriors with the crown form mace in one hand and severed heads in the other. We also see warriors holding or wearing human scalps, so we know that practice started at least 1,000 years ago. What little we know of Mississippian religion also indicates a veneration of war. In their creation story, a culture hero named Red Horn is a warrior with the ability to turn into an arrow. He also has strange little faces on his ears, but that's not important right now. He and his friends, a super-fast turtle and a thunderbird who can spit corn kernels like bullets, fight enemy giants and end up getting their heads chopped off. The giants displayed these heads in their village until Redhorn's twin sons, also warriors, avenged their fathers, killing the giants with magical weapons. For a creation story, it's pretty fighty. Mississippian civilization was still thriving when the first Europeans arrived, so we also have their accounts to rely on. The DeSoto expedition from 1538 to 1541 encountered Mississippian warriors from Florida to Tennessee and all the way out into Oklahoma. To their reckoning, the deadliest weapons of the Mississippians were their longbows. They were much larger and thicker than the European longbow. Their arrows were thick too, and the points were big. It took a lot of strength to draw the bow, but then the arrow could go for hundreds of feet at top speed. They could pierce straight through Spanish armor like it was nothing. DeSoto's men eventually opted for Mississippian armor, which was made of layers of leather and cotton. It was much better suited for stopping a Mississippian arrow. Now, if we step back into pre-European contact times again, I'd argue that the Mississippians stand almost alone in North America as a civilization with institutionalized warfare and a separate class of warriors. Not to say that other ancient North American civilizations were peaceful. Fighting each other happens in pretty much all human cultures, but not all institutionalize and venerate it like the Mississippians did. The ancestral Pueblo and Huhuqam of the American Southwest, they didn't really. In fact, war doesn't show up anywhere in their art or creation stories. Besides maybe the bow and arrow, they really had no weapons to speak of either. Their settlement patterns also show no signs of defensive works. Neither Huhuqam nor ancestral Pueblo communities were built worrying about attack. The same thing could be said of the many cultures of pre-Columbian California. Yes, they had skirmishes, but they were too busy trading with each other to wage real war. Now, some of that might hit your ears strange. Some of you might be saying, "I thought Native Americans were all fierce warriors." Well, maybe that's because they were turned into that by the European invasion. Think about it. You probably live in a pretty peaceful community. But what would happen if you were repeatedly attacked by a group of foreigners? Well, most of the adults would probably take up arms in defense of the city. Your children would grow up scared. That fear would turn into anger as an adult. In just a matter of years, a peaceful community could turn into a militarized one. Most of my listeners grew up with the story of European contact from a Western perspective. They were brave explorers taming the land. But for Native Americans, it was an invasion, and it changed them. It hardened them. Now, come to think of it, there was one more very war-oriented civilization in the Americas, and that was the people of the Pacific Northwest. But rather include them here, I'll make them the subject of my One More Thing segment. I'll take my first commercial break here, and when I return, we'll talk about weapons in ancient Mesoamerica. Hey, this is Ed Barnhart, shamelessly plugging myself again. This time it's about an iPhone app I made called Tulum Be Your Own Guide. It's an app designed to help you be your own guide through Tulum. Its root is a map of Tulum, in which you can click on any building to get a description. You can read that description or press audio to hear me narrate it. It's not a static route through the site. You can go anywhere you want. You can point your phone at any structure and hit the What's That button. You can also click on any building and say Take Me There for a directional arrow and a distance feature function. You can really be your own guide. And though admittedly not my intention, making the app's information as complete as possible, I accidentally wrote the most complete book on Tulum ever made. No other single source has as much information about Tulum. It's only 99 cents, and you can find it on the Apple App Store. Once again, it's called Tulum Be Your Own Guide, and the author is me, Edwin Barnhart. Whether you plan to visit Tulum, or just want to learn more about it, it's an invaluable resource. Mesoamerica has essentially the same deep history as North America. A Paleolithic period, an Archaic period, and finally large sedentary communities start developing around 2000 BCE. The period between roughly 2000 BCE and 200 CE is referred to as either the formative period or the pre-classic. That difference is really just a product of lack of coordination between archaeologists. For the Maya area, it's the pre-classic. And for the rest of Mesoamerica, it's the formative period. Both are the same time frames, and cultures are interacting across that arbitrary line. The big players in the formative are the Olmecs. Starting around 1800 BCE, they're the first to really create what can be called a state-level society. What I find fascinating is the complete lack of evidence suggesting Olmec warfare. Believe me, I've looked high and low. I've searched many artifact catalogs and looked at every piece of Olmec art I can find. And nothing. Not one single image of human-on-human violence. I looked over the artifact logs of early excavations at San Lorenzo for potential weapons, and I found 5 projectile points. Just 5. And those were probably hunting tools, not weapons. Olmec trade partners also show no signs of warfare or violence. The people of the Valley of Mexico would eventually institutionalize warfare, but not back then. The dominant culture at that time and place was Tlatilco civilization. They made thousands of human figurines, doing all sorts of things, but no warriors. Acrobats, yes. Fat-butted ladies, tons. But warriors, zero. I've searched for the first Mesoamerican scene with a weapon in it, and I may be wrong, but I think it's Stela D. from Tres Zapotes, an epi-Olmec site in Veracruz. The stela has no date on it, but its context puts it in between 400 BCE and 100 CE. Stela C., perhaps from the same city era, has a date of 32 BCE carved into its backside. The scene on Stela D isn't much, really. It shows 3 human figures, and the one in the center is dressed like he's the boss. On his left side is a person kneeling, like Maya captives do. On his right is a tall guy holding a spear, not menacingly, more like a guard. That spear is the earliest purpose-made weapon I can find in Mesoamerican art and archaeology. If you know of any other older examples, please share them with me in the comments. Now, about that time, multiple Mesoamerican civilizations hit their stride. We've got the late pre-classic Maya, who are erecting public art in huge cities like Caminalhuyu and El Mirador, but no scenes of warriors holding weapons. We've got the early Zapotecs, who established their capital at Monte Albán as early as 100 BCE. Monte Albán has its famous Danzante stela, images of naked men with mutilated genitals and their guts dribbling out. They're almost certainly sacrifices, but were they obtained through warfare? We can't say for sure, so no smoking gun there, or should I say smoking spear. Come to think of it, that would be a perfect Mesoamerican warrior name, Smoking Spear. I claim dibs on that one. The sleeping giant of the late formative is Teotihuacan. Starting around 250 BCE, they start building a massive city just north of modern-day Mexico City. By 250 CE, they've built the Avenue of the Dead and the gigantic Pyramid of the Sun, the third largest pyramid on the planet. It's those Teotihuacanos who first institutionalize warfare. That's right, I'm blaming them. About that time, they start pushing out into the rest of Mesoamerica, and everywhere they go, warfare imagery starts finding its way into public art. Back home in Teotihuacan, they start building apartment compounds. One close to the city center named Atatelco seems to be a warrior's complex. Its walls are covered in full-color murals. Many of them are still there today. I love visiting the compound. They depict warriors dressed in eagle and coyote costumes, all holding atlatl throwers and short spears. Later on in history, the Toltecs and the Aztecs will have institutionalized warrior classes of eagles and jaguars. I'm not sure why Teotihuacan had coyotes instead, but I am convinced that they started the concept of warrior classes. Teotihuacan's march plows through the Zapotec and lands squarely on Maya civilization. We can't say that it was a military conquest. We just don't have the data for that. But we can say that military themes start showing up in Maya art just around then. And we get a number of elite family members executed and ending up dead in tombs about then. Now, like the Olmec, you really can't find images of warriors, captives, or weapons in pre-classic Maya art. But as soon as Teotihuacan arrives, we start seeing Maya with atlatls. Now, the atlatl had been around for thousands of years, since Paleolithic times. But it had always been a hunting tool. The Teotihuacanos turned it into a weapon. In the Maya world, it, coupled with Teotihuacan's newly shared philosophy of war, inspired a series of Maya wars. Some call them the Petén Wars. Though the Maya cities were independent city-states, it was basically a civil war. You were either Team Tikal or Team Calakmul, the two largest Maya cities. The hieroglyphs document those battles in clear detail, and Maya art filled with war imagery. Many warriors are shown with standard spears and rectangular shields. Leather-padded or a kind of stone-plated armor was worn. Tiny squares of flat stones were sewed together, not unlike the rings of European chainmail. Maya kings were depicted as warriors too, often with humbled captives at their feet. Those kings had jade versions of the armor and ornate atlatl throwers in their hands. Some of them were jaguar paws holding the end of the atlatl spear. Very cool looking. There's a famous pot found at Tikal that seems to document the arrival of the Teotihuacanos and their atlatls. It shows a scene of gift exchange. The Maya are giving Quetzal feathers and receiving atlatl gear in return. Pretty straightforward. Now, Teotihuacan burns to the ground around 650 CE. We still don't know how or why, but we know it left a huge power vacuum in Mesoamerica. The classic period ended soon after, and hundreds of Mesoamerican cities were abandoned. After a few centuries of what archaeology calls the terminal classic, the post-classic begins around 1000 CE. The Maya establish Chichen Itza and fill its public buildings with images of warriors and pitched battles. Still, the weapons of choice are spears and atlatls. And that strikes me as strange because the bow and arrow showed up in Mesoamerica by at least 800 CE. Archaeologists find arrowheads, the types we call bird points in Texas, but warriors are never shown wielding bows. Every once in a while we find an image that might be a bow, but not often and not clearly. We do have images of Maya bird hunters, but they used blowguns, not bows and arrows. For whatever reasons, the atl-atl reigned supreme in Mesoamerican war. In Oaxaca, the Mixtec civilization rose to power. Sometime in the 11th century, a culture hero named Eight Deer unified the Mixtec Empire by force. All five of the remaining Mixtec codices show him conquering town after town, always holding atl-atl gear as he approaches. He's often shown in a group of warriors, all holding atl-atls, but also small circular shields, and they're dressed in colorful padded leather armor. Toltec civilization arises at the same time, again with clearly established classes of warriors. The Toltecs, from all the way up in central Mexico, establish a presence in Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. The art in their capital city of Tula, like Chichen Itza, is dominated by war imagery. Both they and the Maya start wearing a helmet that I love. It's the head of a snake. The snake's eyes and forehead are the skull cap, and its lower jaw is the chin strap. Visually, it makes the warrior look like his face is emerging from the mouth of a snake. Since we know that the Maya represented contact with the supernatural as traveling through the Boots Chan, translated the smoke serpent, warriors with this helmet were saying, "I'm coming straight out of the supernatural onto this battlefield." Pretty cool. Now finally, we get to Mesoamerica's most famous warrior civilization, the Aztecs. By all Spanish accounts, the Aztecs were fearsome warriors. Despite advanced European weapons, like metal swords and armor, and the spread of epidemic diseases, it still took the Spanish almost 3 years to sack the capital city of Tenochtitlan. The Aztecs had two warrior cults, the Eagles and the Jaguars. Each had fantastic uniforms, the Eagles with feathers and talons, the Jaguars with spotted pelts and claws. Helmets and shields were also standard issue. They had atl-atls and spears and knives, but their fearsome new weapon was the macahuitl. You could call it an Aztec sword, but it was a very different thing than a European version of a sword. At the core, it was a wooden bat, but lining two sides were obsidian blades. Each blade was about 2 inches long and inserted into grooves along the bat's surface. Obsidian is the sharpest substance on the planet. An obsidian edge feathers out to an atom of thickness. The problem is that it's brittle. It shatters upon impact with hard objects. But that shortcoming was factored into the brilliant design of the macahuitl. A standard macahuitl had 30 to 40 blades along its length. If a blade broke, it could simply be removed and replaced. They probably fixed them up before and after every battle. The Spanish feared that weapon, openly called it superior to the European sword. One conquistador's chronicle reported that a macahuitl could chop the head off a horse in a single blow. Gosh, there's so much more to say, but I've got to cut myself off somewhere. So I'll take my last commercial break here, and when I return, we'll talk about weapons in ancient South America. In my capacity as the director of Maya Exploration Center, I'll be leading 4 tours this year. My Olmec tour filled up instantly, and my Oaxaca tour is 2 away from full. But my Machu Picchu tour in September still has places. We'll start and end in Lima, visiting museums and a pyramid still standing in the middle of the city. Then we'll fly up to Cusco, the capital of the ancient Inca Empire. After a few days there, we'll head by train to Machu Picchu. Most people take the train out, see it real quick, and head back to Cusco that evening. but I think that's crazy. On my trip, we stay for 2 whole days, fully exploring the ruins, climbing the mountain behind them, and enjoying a fun little tourist town in the valley below. Then after that, we'll make our way back to Cusco through the Sacred Valley, exploring more ruins, eating lunch along the Urubamba, and visiting a little llama farm. I lead different kinds of trips, and they're always fun. If you'd like to come with me to Machu Picchu this September, shoot me an email, and we'll talk about it. Okay, I'm moving to South America. But really, what I'm talking about is Andean civilization. By that, I mean civilizations in and around the Andes Mountains on the west side of the continent. Most of the rest of the continent is the Amazon. And while we have exciting new discoveries being made there every year now, I don't know much about pre-Columbian weaponry from there. So, the story of South American civilizations really begins in the desert valleys along the coastline of Peru. A few hours to the north of modern-day Lima sits the Supe Valley. That's where South America's first cities were built. We call them collectively Supe Corral Civilization. From 3200 to 1800 BCE, about 20 cities worked together to create a trade network and food abundance. The two big cities of that network were Corral along the river but miles inland, and Aspero on the coast. They traded fishing and farming products back and forth in what seemed to be a very peaceful system. Their cities were built without defensive architecture. The art is very limited, but what we do have shows no depictions of violence or warriors. There are skeletons of babies found in the rubble cores of some of their temples, but the suggestions that they were sacrificed are pure conjecture. They don't show any pathology of being killed. Before modern medicine, babies died all the time. High infant mortality rates were just part of ancient life. By the way, Supe Corral was pre-ceramic. Ceramics started around that 1800 BCE mark, and the changes they brought may have been part of the region's abandonment. 1800 to 900 BCE is called the initial period by Andean archaeology. And by the way, I'm getting to weapons. Just bear with me. So, Supe Corral fades around 1800 BCE. But there was another civilization doing their same thing just 5 valleys further north. We call them Kazma Sechin Civilization. We don't have near as much archaeology there, but it's apparent that Kazma Sechin started just as early as Supe Corral, maybe even a few hundred years earlier. But the difference was, Kazma Sechin kept going after 1800 BCE. They accepted ceramics and didn't miss a beat. During that same initial period, the amazing city of Chavín de Huántar is built up in the Andes, and it's really directly above the Kazma Valley. It's covered in religious symbolism, especially my beloved Fang deity. But still, no scenes of violence. Well, okay, there's one severed head image there, but I'm pretty sure it was carved after 900 BCE. Chavín was clearly in contact with the Peruvian coast and the Amazon. The Fang deity is a jaguar, after all. The images of the Fang deity start appearing in the valleys of the coast, but not in the Kazma Valley. By 900 BCE, we see all sorts of highland things arrive, like llamas and guinea pigs, so we know they're in contact with the highlands. But instead of Fang deity iconography, the site of Cerro Sechín builds walls around their city. They cover those walls with over 300 carved scenes of mostly violence, the first of its kind in the Andean world. Warriors are shown holding clubs and axes. Other panels display severed body parts, heads, limbs, guts, eyeballs on stakes like shish kebabs. Multiple panels show people holding axes with severed heads hanging off their belts. To my thinking, this is a shocking and significant event. While the rest of the coastal community seem to be embracing a new religion centered around the Fang deity, the people of Cosma's Valley do not. It's like Shaveen came knocking at Cosma's door saying, "Have you heard about our Lord and Savior, the Fang deity?" And Cosma responded, "Beat it, or we'll pull your eyeballs out." But as Cosma builds walls, the rest of the coast embraces the Fang deity. Way south of Lima, Paracas culture thrives from about 900 to 100 BCE. Their art is covered in Fang deity imagery, but also something else, severed heads. Human figures with Fang deity features hold these heads or have them hanging from their waists. They also hold our first representations of an object called a tumi knife. A tumi knife is not a weapon, but it was clearly used to chop heads off. Honestly, it looks a little ill-suited to the task. It's got a semicircular head as its cutting side and a short handle. It looks more like a bread dough cutting knife than an executioner's axe to me. But later Moche images clearly show people's necks getting chopped with it. It's actually the Moche I've been trying to get to this whole time, so let's just go there now. Cosma Sachin civilization fades around 200 BCE. Within a century, Moche civilization emerges in roughly the same region. But their territory is hugely expanded, not just one valley, but for hundreds of miles up and down the north coast. It's Moche territory now. They combined Cosma's propensity for violence with the worship of the Fang deity. The Moche are South America's first truly militaristic civilization. Warfare was institutionalized and likely mandated by their religion. They were prolific artists. They covered their pyramids with images of the Fang deity, warriors, and captives. We have tens of thousands of Moche-painted ceramics. After the Fang deity, their number one most common theme is warfare. And this is where we see our first purpose-made weapons, aside from the stuff at Cerro Sachin, that is. In battle scenes, we see the Moche using slings for throwing rocks and spears. But the most common weapons were maces. They were designed with a hole in their center, like a donut, so they could slip onto the top of a wooden handle. There was no standard form for their stone heads. In fact, they seemed to vary in a very artistic way. Some were simple discs, others had spikes. Some looked like starbursts or mechanical gears. A few were even carved to look like animals or even vegetables. Since they were made of stone and eventually arsenical copper, they preserved, and we have tons of them in the artifact record. We know exactly what they are. Their ornate nature attests to the ritual, institutionalized violence that they represented. The Moche also used shields, helmets, and armor. Their helmets came to a point on top, and their armor looks to be something like padded leather. We also have armor that came out of royal tombs made with gold and silver plates, but I suspect that was ceremonial and not actually used in battle. There's one very unique part of Moche armor that intrigues me. It's a wide metal plate in the shape of a tumi knife that attaches just above their waistlines and covers their butts. Years ago, on one of my tours, a man named Leo Welch gave me what might be my favorite explanation of that odd piece of armament. The Moche were all about sacrificing people at their temple complexes. That fact is made clear both in art and archaeology. So a warrior's goal in battle was not to kill the enemy, but to capture him alive. Most of them are wielding maces, the kind of weapon that could cave a man's head in. That was certainly what European maces were for. But if you were a Moche warrior with a mandate to capture, not kill, how would you use your mace? Well, one good shot to the lower spine would make the enemy's legs stop working. It wouldn't kill them, but they couldn't run off either. So what's that weird, toomey-shaped back flap? It's probably designed to protect from a mace hit to the lower spine. Chronologically speaking, the Moche were the inventors of Andean warfare. Wari civilization started an expansionistic empire around 500 CE and challenged Moche territories, but with the exact same weapons. Well, okay, they also had the bolas, too, but that was more for tripping up animals, not humans. When the Moche cities were abandoned around 800 CE, Chimu civilization rose in their place. Again, they used the same weapons, the mace, the spear, and the sling. For my money, the Chimu were really just Moche 2.0. The only differences were the valleys they inhabited, and, importantly, a change of political model from city-state to embedded capital. Now finally we get to the Inca, who fielded armies of up to 200,000 men for their campaigns. But in terms of weapons, no new technologies. It was still the stuff the Moche invented. Of course, there were some subtle differences. The Inca were more spear-oriented, and sometimes they'd attach a metal axe head near the top, kind of like a European halberd. An Inca soldier's armor was made by his wife, who typically traveled with him on war campaigns. She also fed him and generally kept his morale up. Inca armor was padded and made of llama hides and wool. The wives weaved the exteriors in the colorful patterns of their home region, so that a regiment of soldiers from one region could be discerned from another. An Inca army probably looked like a rainbow coming at you. But as I say, weapon technology had not advanced for 1,000 years. Apparently, the Moche set the gold standard for Andean civilizations in terms of weapon design. One more thing I'll note. Where was the bow and arrow? It was for sure in the Andes by Inca times. We have the bird points to prove it. And some archaeologists in Chile even believe that they found it going back 4,000 years ago. But whenever it arrived, it never became a weapon. Super strange, but that's what we think we know. I hate it when the artifact record doesn't make sense. But I guess that's just job security for us ditch diggers. Until next month, this is Ed, signing off. You've been listening to ArchaeoEd, a podcast written, recorded, and voiced by me, Ed Barnhart. If you like what you heard, please like, share, comment, and do all that other stuff I'm supposed to ask you to do. And if you really liked it, consider supporting ArchaeoEd through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com and search for ArchaeoEd. I'm in there somewhere. I make these podcasts for free, but I'm not opposed to making money. In fact, if you folks could free me from my day job, well, I'd be much obliged. ArchaeoEd is my intellectual property, all rights reserved, copyright 2024.